Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Mark Levinson. His new book, The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America, just came out in paperback. He joins us by telephone from, I'm guessing, the Washington, D.C. area, from this area code.
That's correct.
Welcome back to WYSO.
Thank you, Vic.
So how did you decide to do this project? This is an amazing project.
Well, you know, there's been this discussion going on the past several years about particularly Walmart and all the changes that it's been making in American retailing. And this discussion has been totally ahistorical. It's as if modern retailing began with Walmart. Well, actually, modern retailing began a whole lot earlier than that. Discounting began a whole lot earlier than that. And between then and the rise of Walmart, we actually had decades and decades of political warfare about whether discount retailing should even be allowed. And so as I learned more and more about this story, I was persuaded that it would become a pretty interesting book. So that's really what I devoted my time to. And it really goes to, I think, a fundamental split in our own self-conception. You know, we like to think that America is the free market capitalist economy, and we all pat ourselves on the back for our free market orientation and all of that kind of stuff. We're capitalist, yay. On the other hand, if you look at the history of discounting and of chain retailing, you see we actually don't like free markets very much in many ways. They're uncomfortable to us because they destroy old familiar things. They destroy our local businesses. They destroy our local social structures. And so we like change to be controlled. We really don't like wild and woolly capitalism as much as we think we do.
I grew up in Iowa, and I can remember all those thriving little downtown business areas in all those small Iowa towns where they had the hardware store and the drug store. And now you go to most of those towns, and there's a big Walmart out there by the highway, and the towns are mostly shuttered up. And I guess that's what a lot of these people were protesting in regard to Walmart. And going back to the days of A&P, all those little neighborhood grocery stores, there was one on every corner.
That is exactly right. There were, in 1929, which is the first time the government counted them, there were something on the order of 600,000 mom-and-pop grocery stores in the United States. And back then, of course, the population was about a third of what it is now. So just think of that, 600,000. So it was something on the order of one grocery store for every 51 households. So literally, in almost every part of the country, you could walk down to the corner store. And this was a huge source of employment. We're again talking the 1920s. If you lost your job at a factory or on the railroad or wherever you worked, it wasn't hard to go into the grocery business. You could get credit from a wholesaler. You needed to raise a little bit of money for rent on a store. You could pay a dollar or two to buy a book that would tell you how to be a grocer. And poof, you were in business. You were an entrepreneur, and you could pursue the American dream. Mm-hmm. So tens of thousands of people did this every year, and they were very much threatened by the rise of a big chain store that could sell things more cheaply and might put them out of business, and that was the Great A&P.
My guest is Mark Levinson. His book is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. I have vague memories of being a boy and going to an A&P store in Des Moines. And I remember it was kind of dusty and wasn't particularly a thriving store. And then I read your book, and I was astounded. You mentioned 1929 as being the year they did that survey. It's also the year we had the big stock market crash. It's also the year A&P did $1 billion in business. And we think about 1929 dollars, and the next closest competitor was Sears with $415 million. That's a lot of business. That's a lot of money. It's amazing.
It was an enormous company. In 1929, A&P had almost 16,000 stores in the United States. 16,000. And so it was everywhere. And think, by the way, of the management challenge of running a company with 16,000 stores when you didn't have computers, when a long-distance phone call was horrendously expensive. This was a really difficult managerial task just to coordinate this huge entity. But it was everywhere, and people felt like it was omnipresent and was stifling the local merchants, was hurting mom and pop. People in the 1920s and 1930s used to complain about the foreign retailers taking your money, and foreign did not mean from another country. Foreign meant from out of town.
Right.
And so please don't shop with those foreign retailers that are going to take your money to New York or Chicago. Shop with the local guys and leave your money in town.
Well, the real geniuses behind the A&P were these brothers who came into the business. Their father had worked for the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, and these brothers came in, and I didn't want to admire them when I first started reading your book. I didn't want to even admire the A&P, and by the time I was finished with the book, I was saying, these guys really got a bad deal. These guys were geniuses.
There were two brothers. This book actually started out as a biography. And I thought I was going to do a biography of John and George Hartford. And that proved not to be possible because George Hartford, who was the older of the two brothers, was about the most reclusive individual you could imagine. And so there was really not much to write about. George Hartford was a numbers guy. He won a prize in algebra when he was in high school. Which was 10th grade. And he spent the rest of his life doing finances for this company. And so he was the genius who kept the company financially sound all through the war and the Great Depression and the assaults against the chain stores. And then his younger brother, John, had a totally different personality. John was personable, outgoing, bon vivant. He loved to be with people. He was the one who went out and met employees. He was the one who went out and met suppliers. When the political pressure grew and A&P started to have to talk publicly, John was the one who did it. And John had an extraordinarily acute sense of changing public tastes. So over the course of their careers, and between them, these two brothers worked for the A&P for 143 years. Over the course of their careers, they totally remade this company four times as retail needs changed. And each time you could see John saying, we need to change, we need to do things different, the world is changing, we have to step up here. And you could say George saying, okay, but we've got to make a profit. We can't lose money here. And that combination worked. That combination worked.
And John, he was the one who said, his mantra was, we've got to have the lowest prices. And this was really a stroke of genius.
Well, if you go back 100 years ago now, talking sort of 1912, 1913, you didn't have much by way of what we would consider modern accounting concepts. So think about the question, what does it mean to make a profit? Well, the way it was usually talked about in retailing in those days was if the store purchased a cigar from a wholesaler for 2 cents and it sold a cigar for 3 cents, it had made a 50% profit. And the advice given to storekeepers was you want to make as much profit as you can, which is to say you want to have as much markup on each item as you can get away with. And John looked at this and said, this is nuts. You're not interested in your markup. You shouldn't care about your markup on each item. That has nothing to do with profit. You should be concerned about your return on investment. And maybe if you lower prices, take a lower markup on each item, you'll get more customers coming through the store, and you will get a bigger return on investment. And this is what A&P did for the first time 100 years ago this year. They created something called the Economy Store, which was a new format, bare bones, no fancy decorations, no delivery, no trading stamps, and the lowest possible prices on a very limited assortment of merchandise. And they discovered that customers loved it.
Mm.
And that even though they made a lot less money on each item they sold, they made a much bigger return on their investment just because they had a lot more people coming through the stores. And that was a totally revolutionary idea in 1912. That was really the beginning of A&P's transformation from kind of a middling grocery store company to, within 7 years, the biggest retailer in the world.
So in 1912, 100 years ago, they rolled out that sweeping change, the economy store. And isn't 1912 also about the time when these stores started to become a political issue?
1912 was the year that Woodrow Wilson ran for president, and stores did start to become a political issue. You had a lot of argument, including from Louis Brandeis, who was one of Wilson's big advisors and later became a Supreme Court justice. And Wilson, Brandeis made the argument, and Wilson endorsed this, that too much consumer choice, too much discounting was a bad thing, okay, because you would sow uncertainty in the minds of consumers. So you were actually better off in an economy where you didn't have so much bargaining, where everything had its proper price and people knew what it was, and people paid that price. And so, you know, Brandeis's position, which Wilson supported, is that you should really have limits on discounting, that a small merchant should be able to buy its goods from the manufacturer at the same price as the big merchant. You shouldn't support big companies with volume discounts. So it would be fair to everybody to have the same price.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, John Hartford obviously didn't think that was a terrific idea, and it was really a very anti-consumer idea, that essentially said consumers are going to pay more than they need to pay because it's too stressful for them to shop around.
Mm. My guest is Mark Levinson. His book is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. It just came out in paperback. The wheels, they did grind slowly. We had all these states that were putting onerous taxes on chain stores, basically taxing away all their profits in various regions. And we also had these congressmen and senators, Wright Patman in particular, who were really going after A&P. And ultimately, in 1946, the Hartford brothers were found to have committed criminal antitrust. And this really shattered the company, didn't it?
They were found to have committed criminal antitrust violations by selling groceries too cheaply, which is what's fascinating about this case. You know, think about why we have antitrust law. I mean, the whole notion here is that a company is controlling trade for the purpose of driving prices up.
Uh-huh.
And here you had the Hartfords, according to the government's story, controlling trade for the purposes of driving prices down. But that was judged to be a violation of federal antitrust law, and it was a criminal offense.
This is truly an amazing story, and I love the early days of the A&P when they were first getting into the tea business and the coffee business, and this is just an intriguing period.
Yes, back A&P got its start right around the beginning of the Civil War. Nobody knows precisely when. And it the Hartford family mythology was that the Hartfords had started it. The John and George Hartford's father, who's named George H. Hartford, it was claimed to be the founder, which he wasn't. But that was the family mythology. The founder was actually a guy named George Gilman. And George Gilman was a showman, kind of in the model of P.T. Barnum, who was very active in that time. And so George Gilman's notion was that if you made the tea business entertaining, more people would come to your store. Now, here you've got tea, which is a pretty generic product, right? All the tea merchants essentially were buying tea from the same sources. They were selling the same tea. How do you make it different? Well, first of all, they came up with the idea of selling tea by mail. Okay, they were promising you the lowest price if out in your town in Ohio or Iowa or wherever you happen to be, you'd form a buying club. You'd send in your orders by mail to New York, and the person who organized it would get a free pound of tea. Now, in the 1860s, this was a pretty revolutionary way of merchandising. Nobody had ever done this before. Mm. And then they pioneered the use of premiums. As they built stores around the country, if you would come into one of their tea stores, they would give you a printed color picture, a chromolithograph. Mm. These were all the rage after the Civil War, and you could collect them. If you shopped at the Great Atlantic and Pacific, you bought your tea there. Every time you went in, you could get a picture of a president or of a sports star or of an entertainer or of a bird, and you could have a series of these to put on your wall.
Mm-hmm.
So we had premiums at a very early time in American history. And so just by relentless promotion, George Gilman basically turned one of hundreds of little tea companies into a company that pretended to be great. And it called itself the Great Atlantic and Pacific because it renamed itself in 1869, the year of the Transcontinental Railroad. And basically the whole marketing was a series of stunts to persuade you that this company was great so that you'd send in your money.
Gilman really was an entrepreneur, wasn't he?
He was an absolute entrepreneur. He was a real marketing genius.
Yeah. The book is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. Mark Levinson wrote it. He joins us on the program today. 1912, wasn't that also the year that the U.S. Postal Service was allowed to use parcel post? That was a big thing, too, wasn't it?
That's correct, yes. And parcel post was in some ways comparable to Amazon today.
Okay? Uh-huh.
It meant that people could order things from out of town and have them delivered even if they lived out in a rural area. Remember, half the population then was living on the farm or in small towns, and they were not served by the railroads or by Railway Express, but with parcel post, now they could order by mail. They could send in their order to a merchant in Chicago or New York or wherever and get the best goods or the cheapest price. So it introduced a new level of competition into retailing.
And 100 years later, we look at this postal service that we have now and how it's developed. The railroads were a big part of that. Being able to have parcel posts was a big part of that. And the efficiencies that were created. And now we see it in this dire situation. And I think we forget that 100 years ago, parcel post changed the world for Americans.
For the half of America that was pretty isolated on farms or small towns, parcel post absolutely opened the world. Before then, if you lived out on a farm and you wanted to order something from the big city or send something to the big city, you had to get into your horse and buggy and trot 30 or 40 miles to the nearest railroad station.
Uh-huh.
And so you were really isolated, and parcel post changed that.
This book that we're talking about today, The Great A&P, I heard about it from Robert Fogarty, the editor of the Antioch Review. He said, you've got to check out this book. And he mentioned that you are an alum of Antioch College. And we were chatting before we went on the air, and you mentioned that you used to do programming at WYSO. What was it like back in the day?
I used to do news on WYSO many years ago.
What was that like?
Well, just to reveal something about my age, we ripped the news back in those days from a teletype machine. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners know what a teletype machine was, but suffice it to say that it sat in the studio and clacked away as the Associated Press brought us the news letter by letter, and the teletype machine typed it out on big sheets of paper that you could rip from the printer and read on the air.
You know, I hate to tell you this, Mark, but 20 years ago when I first came to the station, I think we were still doing that. Yeah, that's a wonderful memory. So you would wait for the news to come in. Could you hear the teletype machine in the background when you listened to the radio?
No, it was outside the studio.
Okay,
but that was our connection with the world, basically, no. and That was, I think, before NPR.
So it was
an independent station, and people spun records and did other kinds of programming.
So we're dating you in the 1960s, I'd say.
1970s, please.
Oh, okay. All right. I understand Bob mentioned another book that you've written all about how container shipping changed the world. Now, I have not read this book, but I find this to be another fascinating subject.
Yes, I published a book a couple of years ago. It's called The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger. And it's really a history of containerization. The container is something that seems to everybody as a very obvious product, not something you would need to invent. But actually, containerization made for huge economic changes because it lowered the price of international freight and made possible globalization. Now, people talk very glibly about globalization, but globalization really involves getting things from here to there. And the container made it possible to do that cheaply, and so really opened the way to the very international economy that we have today. And the story of how the container actually developed and came into widespread use is, I think, a pretty interesting one. It's a lot more complex than you might think, and there were an awful lot of people who were involved to make it happen.
Mark Levinson joins us on the program today. I'm guessing that I have a few listeners out there who are wondering, now how did this guy go from reading the news at Antioch College to his current gig? What was your career path? How did you get to where you are today, and what have you done?
Well, from reading the news at Antioch College, I ended up unqualified for anything but journalism. And so I spent many, many years as an economic journalist. And my take on these books is essentially an economist's take on them. In The Box, for example, I'm really not interested in ships. I'm really interested in how a change in the cost of transportation really changed the world economy, and in a pretty significant way. In the story of the great A&P, one of my interests here is that the change in the cost of distributing food because of the efficiencies of a company like A&P had enormous, enormous economic implications that no one has paid much attention to. You know, writers have tended to focus a lot on manufacturing and not really very much on retailing. It's not a sexy industry. But yet, here we've got a case in which this company, this enormous company, dramatically reduced the cost of distributing food with implications for every American family. If you go back to the 1920s, the average household in the United States spent about a third of its income on food.
Mm.
And today, the amount that we spend on food at home is somewhere in the area of 7%. So now it's almost, you know, going to the grocery store now is, I don't want to say an afterthought, but it's really not the most expensive thing in your life. In the 1920s, people spent more on food than they did on housing. And reducing that is an enormous economic achievement that just had huge consequences for Americans. And so that's really why I wanted to write about that story.
And I understand that you spent some time with The Economist.
I did. I was the finance and economics editor of The Economist in London for a couple of years.
That must have been a fun job.
An interesting job. An interesting place to work.
Yeah. Our guest is Mark Levinson. His book is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. Reading your extensive notes at the end of the book, I thought to myself, I wonder how long this project took, and I wonder how he decides, I'm going to get my teeth into this project, and I'm going to hunker down and write this book. What's the process?
Well, it's easy to come up with ideas for books. The thing is, to make a book like this work, you really have to find people and stories, okay? Because nobody wants to read a book about the grocery trade, per se, right?
Uh-huh.
But as you start doing the research, you come upon characters. You come upon fascinating stories that actually were very relevant in the development of what you're talking about. I'll give you an example. One of the people who walks across the pages of the A&P book is a guy named W.K. Henderson, a guy I'd never heard of.
Is this the radio guy?
This is the radio guy.
He's my favorite character in the book.
Okay, so back in the 1920s, when basically anybody could set up a radio station, W.K. Henderson, who was from a wealthy family in Shreveport, Louisiana, and was a big businessman in his town and owned a little steel company and some other things, he bought a radio station. And there were no networks then, so he had to figure out what he was going to fill his airtime with. And so, of course, one of the things he filled his airtime with was speeches by people in town. So W.K. Henderson went to the Rotary Club one day and heard this local man give a speech about the evils of chain stores, how chain stores were hurting the local businesses. And he said to him, "Why don't you come on out to my studio tonight, and you can give your speech again and broadcast it on the air?" Well, this happened, and all these telegrams came in to Henderson from all over the South about the chain store evil and how great it was that he'd put this man on the air talking about the problems caused by chain stores. And so Henderson decided, hey, there's money to be made here. And he became the leader of the anti-chain store movement, with which he'd previously been involved not at all. And every night his radio station would send out broadcasts about the evils of chain stores. He was somewhat, I don't want to say the Rush Limbaugh of his day, but there's something of talk radio here that, he found that this was a popular cause, and it was one that, he could make hay with. And so he would have speakers every night on his program about chain stores. He'd have grocers come in and talk about how the A&P and the other big companies were putting him out of business. And for several years, he did a pretty good business building his radio station. He was in the late 1920s, he was the most popular radio personality in the country, and it's because people tuned into him to hear about the evils of chain stores.
On the Clear Channel. That's just one of many stories in this book. Mark Levinson has been my guest today. His book is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America, and it's really great to have you back on WYSO, at least for a half hour.
Vic, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. If you miss an edition of The Book Nook, we have an archive of previous programs at the WYSO website. When you go to wyso.org, you can listen to those podcasts anytime you want. And while you're at the website, why don't you consider making a gift to WYSO? As we close out the year and head into a new year, many folks are giving gifts to their loved ones. And if WYSO is one of your loved ones, why don't you make a pledge and support programs like this one? And thanks. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.